It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media. Today we talk with the doyenne of cookbook editors, Judith Jones. Now, Judith didn't set out to edit cookbooks, yet she discovered Julia Child, Marcella Hazan, and a clutch of other greats. Her new memoir is The Tenth Muse, My Life in Food. Well, consummate cookbook author and baker Dori Greenspan has an Achilles heel. She can't resist testing gadgets, and it's led to some good gift picks. Then it's a culinary detective who's unearthed dessert recipes from bygone eras. Remember Baked Alaska? And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. So let's get things rolling with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the road food column in Gourmet Magazine. Jane, Michael, I think this is about the time of year you head south. Am I right?
Yeah. I mean, we head south all the time. But yes, Lynn, this is when we head south. And let me tell you about what we found on our most recent trip at a place called Loopy's in Charlotte, North Carolina. Was absolutely fabulous squash casserole, which is a very, very southern dish. Do you know what?
No, I don't.
Squash casserole is prepared in a number of different ways, but at Loopy's, it's the traditional way, which is slices of yellow crook squash with cheese sauce and cornbread crumbles on the top. And it's one of those dishes that people who hate vegetables suddenly realize they love vegetables because you can't taste the vegetable at all. You just taste the cheese sauce and the bread crumble and the butter.
Well, in fact, Loopy's is the type of place where you can go for an all-vegetable plate. That's one of the items on the menu, and it's a great choice because included among the vegetables are that thing that only in the South is known as a vegetable, which is macaroni and cheese. And
another good vegetable.
An excellent vegetable, in my opinion.
Right. And Jell-O is also a vegetable.
Well, and let me tell you, the macaroni and cheese at Loopy's is sensational. And I have, Jane and I are macaroni and cheese connoisseurs, I dare say.
Or snobs.
And this stuff is really good. And the carrots. I mean, carrots are an honest vegetable. Simply big hunks of carrots sweetened with a little brown sugar. They're great. I mean, you just don't get carrots like this in too many restaurants.
Now, we sort of invented a dish there because we picked and chose, right? Chose from two sides of the menu. Okay, it's the South, and they're famous for their vegetable plates. But there was also a little part of the menu that raved about their chili. And they have not only Cincinnati chili, but Texas chili with no beans in it.
Mm-hmm. And vegetarian chili.
So we asked whether we could get the Texas chili put on the fabulous macaroni and cheese. And they were more than delighted to do it. And I have to say, we should get a Nobel Prize for this combination.
I think we call this Stern's Fusion.
That's right. Fusion cuisine at Loopy's.
Rim.
Let me tell you, the term fusion cuisine has never, ever been applied to Loopy's prior to this, because it's not that kind of a place. I mean, one of the charms of Loopy's is that, you know, in a world of kind of corporate restaurants and restaurants striving to be upscaled, it's a really homey, folksy place. It's been around for a long time. You know, they don't make a big effort to make it seem at all modern, and it isn't, and that's part of its charm.
Is it open all day? Can you go there for dinner? And
oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Lunch and supper are the times to go. And there's a real kind of community feeling about it. One of the things...
It seems like everybody knows everybody there.
And the walls are decorated not only with pictures of Elvis Presley, but also with photographs of all the people that have worked there over the years, all the staff members.
Huh.
And that gives it a real kind of folksy charm that you don't see too many places.
But you know that feeling that everybody knows everybody? I think that's so typical of Charlotte.
Absolutely. And Charlotte also, I don't know if you've had this experience, Lynn, is one of those towns where kind of there's a lot of restaurants that you take out-of-towners to, and then there are the places for the people who are real Charlotte herbs,
yes,
you know. And,
yes, yeah.
And Lupi's is one of the hidden treasures of Charlotte that, you know, if people like you enough, they'll share that with you. And this is how we found out about it.
Every time I've been to Charlotte, you know, it's either been great fried chicken or good barbecue or the great burger. And I know there are upscale restaurants and I know they're great, but it's just
a great,
yeah, well, it's a great eating town. But you're right. And people just seem to, they're nice. I guess that's the only way to put it.
Lupi's also has really serious sweet tea, which is served in a mason jar, which I always kind of enjoy. It's just a great place.
Hey, this sounds swell. Hey, guys, thank you.
Okay, Lynn.
All right,
take care.
Lynn. Bye.
Stick shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Gina Michael Stern are the authors of Two for the Road. Now, the Sterns check in with us every week, but you can get their food finds anytime you want. You know, the website, splendidtable.org. Well, now, I have to tell you about a new intriguing website, at least new for me. It's the site of a store in San Francisco called Le Sanctuaire. Now, this is where you go to find the accoutrements of the new kitchen science that chefs are toying with right now, like the PacoJet machine. Now, this mixes and purees frozen foods directly from their frozen state, no thawing required. And the description says that the PacoJet pays for itself in 3 months, which is a good thing since it costs $3,450. Now, there's the GastroVac that infuses foods with flavors like asparagus infused with coconut water. And there's a molecular gastronomy department with gels and other ingredients only a science-crazed cook could love. But Le Sanctuaire has more mainstream stuff. Foods, unusual books, spices. So I did a trial order of allspice and cinnamon. Well, the cinnamon from Vietnam has got to be the most potent I have ever had. An 8-ounce package cost $6. That's ridiculously cheap. Which makes it a little easier to contemplate the $10,000 RotoVal machine. And please don't ask what it does because I haven't figured it out yet. I've put all the information about Le Sanctuaire on the website, splendidtable.org. Food writer and cookbook author Dori Greenspan cannot resist trying out kitchen equipment. She's always test driving something new. Now, Dori is the author of many baking books, but I think my favorite of the bunch is Baking From My Home to Yours. Hey, Dori, welcome back.
Good to be with you.
All right, let's talk gifts for the cook.
Okay, and I'm going to save your credit card this time.
Great.
Okay, I've got a bunch of gadgets that are really great, and the most expensive is $30. And I actually went to look for a $30 gadget when I gave a wedding present to some friends of mine. Uh-huh. I went to their online registry, and the only thing they were missing was a colander. But the colander they had registered for was $70.
What was it, gold-plated?
Well, I'm glad you felt that way. I mean, I thought, am I just, you know, out of it? No, it fit the rest of their pots and pans. And so I bought it. But it sent me into the gadget department to look and see what else is out there. And it appears that colanders are in fashion again. There are all kinds of new colanders. And the two that I really like, one is made by OXO, the Good Grips people.
Right.
And it's a metal colander, and it has these really neat, heavy, sturdy rubber feet that help the colander to stand up. And then you can open them and extend them, and you can put the colander over your sink, which is just great.
That's
when
great.
You're draining.
Yeah.
Good idea.
Yeah.
$30, not $70.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And the other colander that I really liked, especially since I live in an apartment, is the silicone collapsible colander. It's so great. It's like a magician's hat. You just tap it, and it collapses into itself, and you can store it flat. It's terrific. And that's also $30.
Does that one really hold up? Because I've seen it, and I've wondered, you know, I'd hate to think of having stuff in it, and it would collapse on me.
Ooh, what a thought. I've used it for a while, not long enough to know whether or not after years and years it will hold up. But it looks pretty sturdy. I mean, I've fallen madly in love with silicone. The other silicone tool that I like is made by a company called Sheffin, and it's called a Switch It. And it's a sturdy silicone spatula.
Right.
There's a wider spatula on one side, and then you just switch it and, you know, just turn it over, and it's a little narrower, and it's $10, and it's really a good just grab it and use it tool. Also, have you ever used a ceramic knife or a ceramic peeler?
No, but I've read about them.
Lynn, I'm crazy about the peeler. It's made by Kyocera. It's about $12 or $15, and it's one of those harp-shaped peelers,
right,
you know, V-shape.
Right.
It's just, first of all, it's elegant. It's just there's something very beautiful about it, and boy, can it peel a potato in no time. Great, great gift.
Until I decided to smash a clove of garlic with the side of the blade, I had a ceramic knife by Kyocera, and I liked it a lot. It was like using a razor, for goodness sakes.
Yeah, but not made for smashing.
Yeah, yeah. I learned that the hard way. Okay, one more thing.
Oh, can I give you two? Can I give you the screw-pull champagne cork popper? It's just $10, and it looks like the Seattle Space Needle. You put it over the top of a champagne bottle, you turn, and the cork goes pop right into the top of this little gadget. It's so easy, and it works every time. And then the other thing, it's not a gadget, but it's so much fun that I have to tell you about it. It's a game. It's called Foodie Fight, and it's the trivial pursuit for those of us who love food. It is so much fun. It's 1,000 questions. It'll keep everybody busy all through the holidays.
Dory, thank you.
You're welcome.
Dory Greenspan is author of Baking from My Home to Yours. Now, you can find Dory's gadget picks on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, sign up for our two e-newsletters, Weeknight Kitchen. This is our weekly attempt to make your midweek kitchen life a little simpler. You get a new recipe each week, along with shopping and technique tips. And there's our seasonal e-newsletter, Baker's Chronicle. Great recipes for weekend baking. And the best news is, both of them are free. So sign up, splendidtable.org. Coming up, the woman behind so many great cookbooks and lost desserts. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. You should know that the power behind a great book isn't solely the author. Great books have great editors, and great editors, well, ideally they have all the craft and love of a gifted parent. Well, when I tally up pivotal cookbooks, one name keeps coming up, Judith Jones. Now, Judith is now senior editor and vice president at the publisher Alfred Knopf. Yet in the early 60s, she was way down on the totem pole when she discovered Julia Child. Then came Marcella Hazan, Matur Jaffrey, and so many more. Well, Judith has written a memoir, The Tenth Muse, My Life in Food. Judith, it's good to have you back.
Well, it's so nice to be talking to you again.
You know, I had a great smile when I read the very first sentence of the book about your mother asking you a question. Could you tell us about that?
Yes, when she was well along in her 90s, she called me once over to her, and she said, Judith, I have a very important question to ask you. And I thought, oh, goodness, she's going to ask me whether I believe in an afterlife or something very important. And then she looked me straight in the eye, and she said, do you really like garlic? I had to say, yes, yes, I love it. And she looked so crestfallen, as though this wayward daughter of hers was beyond redemption.
Oh, so I'm hesitant to ask, but what was food like when you were growing up in your house?
Well, she was English, and it was good food. Mm-hmm. But they were very suspicious of anything that was tainted with too much seasoning or a sauce. What was the sauce hiding? Something not good
right.
to begin
yeah.
with.
Now, you went away to college, and then you went to France. What
yes.
happened? I mean, you went there for a brief stay, right?
I went there for a 3-week vacation. I stayed 3.5 years. And I found the letters that I had written to my parents during that period, and I just could not believe this young girl. I thought, that was me at 24. She's so sure of herself. She's so cheeky. She's so manipulative. I was constantly trying to justify my staying and to convince them that in France, food was not considered demeaning. It was an art. That was one of my letters. And then another one that was very funny was when I had moved into this house with the editor of a magazine who hired me and later became my husband. And he was living with several other of his editors in this big house up in the 16th arrondissement. And my letters to my parents started, "Dearest ones, about this matter of cohabitation." Then I went on to explain that you had to live with people in order to afford the rent. And I certainly didn't want girls with their stockings hanging all over the place.
Much better to have men. Much better.
But that was pretty cheeky. Don't forget, this was 1948.
That
girls
was really
didn't behave
cheeky.
That way.
I mean, they must have been having apoplexy.
They were. They were.
And eventually, it was Evan Jones, right? And eventually married.
Yeah.
And Evan wrote a great deal about food.
He did. Well, during that period in France, we just fell in love with the French way with food. I mean, it was a part of life. They'd go to the market two and three times, standing in line in the charcuterie and the boulangerie and maybe toes sticking through old carpet slippers. This was just pretty soon after the war.
Mm-hmm.
But food was all important. And I remember once being in a little boulangerie and somebody opened a baguette and cried out with pleasure, a man. And everybody took up the cry as they looked at the spread. And I said, "What's this all about?" And they said, "The flour is white and pure again." And it just sent something through me. I so identified with that and wanted to be like that. So when we came back, it was kind of a wasteland then. And everybody was quick and easy and box-top recipes.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You couldn't buy some of the essential things like leeks and shallots and fresh herbs and fresh mushrooms. They just weren't in the supermarkets. So it was kind of hard to duplicate. And I also realized how little I knew. But there was no book. Everything was little truncated, short formula recipes.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't, there was nobody there to teach you.
And that's when you started working with Julia Child on Mastering the Art of French Cooking.
Yes, it was when this huge tome on French cooking landed on my desk. It was like an answer to my prayers, whereas the editors up at Houghton Mifflin in Boston said, "Mrs. Child, no American woman wants to know that much about French cooking." Well, I did, and they were wrong.
And so legends are born.
Yeah.
But you didn't start out to edit cookbooks, but from Mastering, you went on to edit some of the pivotal books that were shaping tastes in the United States and continue to shape tastes. What draws you to a writer or to a book proposal?
Well, sometimes it isn't even a book proposal. I would sometimes go out and seek some of these people. But I did find what I was convinced of was that Mastering really had that potential of changing the way cookbooks were written so that you could really make somebody confident and knowledgeable, really translate a cuisine for that home cook. And what I found was that very often the voice would be that of somebody who was abruptly driven from the home of their childhood and longed for those memories as taste to reconnect with the past. And that's what happened to Claudia Roden. Her family was a Sephardic family living in Cairo. She had three different grandparents who came from Aleppo.
Mm-hmm.
That was her world, and abruptly they had to leave. And so she started trying to reconnect with family and friends, went to the British Museum, pored over the whole history of this food, and came up with this really wonderful, loving book a book of Middle Eastern food, and it really it changed America because little by little we became familiar with those ingredients and they became a part of our culture. And that's the wonderful thing about America too. We don't hang on to a single past tradition, but we're so open to new tastes.
Yeah. Judith, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, I always enjoy talking with you. Thank you.
Judith Jones is author of The Tenth Muse, My Life in Food. Judith left us with the first recipe that she sent home to her parents from France. You can find Frenchified meatloaf on the website, splendidtable.org. Desserts have special powers. The way I see it, there's no other part of the meal that can evoke glamour or nostalgia or romance like certain desserts. Now, granted, this is a personal taste, but it seems to be shared by food writer and cooking teacher Gail Monahan. She's done a beautiful book of nostalgic recipes called Lost Desserts, Delicious Indulgences of the Past. Gail, welcome.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Gail, how lost are we talking here? I mean, where do the desserts come from?
Well, we're talking about different levels of lost. The desserts primarily come from restaurants that have closed and the occasional chef that is no longer with us.
Mm-hmm.
I have nostalgic memories of desserts from my own childhood, which is how the book started. I grew up in Los Angeles, and my parents took me often out to dinner, and we ate at wonderful restaurants, all of which are now closed. And, of course, as a child, what I remembered most clearly were the desserts. I'm a great believer that you could ruin a whole dinner, you know, if you're cooking it at home. And if you come up with some spectacular, glamorous, beautiful dessert, people will go away thinking they've eaten very well and been pampered.
I'm with you.
You know, I'm big on desserts.
You said in the introduction of the book, you painted this picture of how the book began, and you talked about a particular cake that you still make that comes straight out of your childhood.
Oh, yes. It was my favorite childhood dessert. It was the coffee crunch cake from Blum's. And, I mean, I remember having it from the time I was little. My grandmother used to take me to Blum's in Beverly Hills.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just this marvelous, magical cake with coffee whipped cream and lots of layers and just covered in this crunchy, wonderful thing that you can make at home in your kitchen, you know, pretty easily. And that's how the book started, because my aunt had sent me a recipe at some point from the San Francisco Chronicle from the 70s. But then much later, I started making the cake and then brought it to a birthday dinner for a food editor at House and Garden. And all the House and Garden staff there loved it. And we talked during the dinner and we said, you know, there has to be a lost desserts article for House and Garden. I mean, House and Garden now is closed and it's also lost. But in any case, that's only recent. So it started with that cake, and the cake was included in the article. And from the article evolved a book.
One of the running themes in this book, as far as I'm concerned, is luxury. And then there's another theme of decadence, which goes hand in hand. Is there, in those categories, are there one or two recipes that really stand out for you?
Oh, let me think. In decadence, for some reason, I think of the pruneau au pichet, which means prunes in a pitcher. And it was made in a very fabulous 3-star restaurant in Vienne, France, called La Pyramide. And one of the most famous chefs of all time, Ferdinand Poin, had this restaurant.
Yeah.
And kings and queens and monarchs and royalty and movie stars came from all over the world many times, made this pilgrimage to Vienne for this chef and this restaurant. But one of the people who came a tremendous number of times was the Aga Khan III. And he apparently had a great appetite, and sometimes he came with friends or groups or his wife, but sometimes he came alone. And when he came alone, apparently he ate enough for eight. He ate a banquet for eight all by himself. And one of the things he loved were these prunes in a pitcher, which were prunes that had been soaked in red wine and port and macerated with sugar for a long time and then served with a pitcher of heavy cream. And it became his signature dessert there. And then he gave Poin this fabulous, antique, amazing pitcher, ceramic pitcher covered with Islamic motifs, which then every time he came after that, the chef served him these prunes in the pitcher. And they, you know, then started referring to it, you know, as the Pruneau au Pichet. So that one is pretty decadent just because of so much Bordeaux and so much port in it.
My very favorite story in the book is the one that's attached to what I think of as one of the classic retro desserts. It's the Baked Alaska story. Can you tell that one?
Well, Baked Alaska, just for anyone who doesn't know, the sort of raison d'etre of Baked Alaska is cold with hot. You surround cold ice cream with cake and meringue, which insulates it. You put all that in the oven. The meringue becomes browned and warm. The cake becomes warm, and the ice cream stays cold. So that's what it is. So it's sort of a magical dessert in that way. You know, sort of is counterintuitive. And Romanoff's was this amazing restaurant in Beverly Hills that was started by this man called Henry Gergson. But Henry Gergson didn't go by that name anymore. And he said that he was a prince, sometimes a prince, he said, sometimes he said a duke, Prince or Duke Michael Romanoff of Russia. And sometimes he said he killed Rasputin. Sometimes he said he was descended from William Gladstone, a prime minister in England. Sometimes he said he went to Harvard. Sometimes he said he went to Yale. I mean, none of this was true. I mean, he was the greatest imposter of all time. And Hollywood, I mean, he sort of just seduced Tinseltown with all of this. They knew it wasn't true, but they wanted to believe the story. And he went on to start this fabulous, famous restaurant. Everybody came. Movie stars. You know, it was famous, famous, famous. And he was just such a character. He finagled himself into the movies. And through that, he got Daryl Zanuck and I think Cary Grant and some other people to invest $7,500 to start Romanoff's, which they all did, assuming they would have a grand tax write-off. And within a few months, it was making money, and within a year, he'd paid them all back. I mean, he was a huge eccentric. He had these two bulldogs, Socrates and Mr. Confucius, and they sat with him every night at dinner in the restaurant. I mean, he was just off the wall.
And he came up with this great Baked Alaska that he served to everybody, so that made him even more famous.
I mean, you know, the dessert is wonderful and easy to make and impressive.
Hey, Gail, thanks for talking with us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
Gail Monahan is author of Lost Desserts, Delicious Indulgences of the Past. Now, you can get Gail's recipe for Romanoff's Baked Alaska, you know where, on the website, splendidtable.org. Chefs working with local farmers are no longer the exception. I mean, few new restaurants risk not having the word local on their menu. But a chef committed to a single farmer and his cultural and culinary tradition, now that's not so usual. Journalist Lisa Moorhead reports from San Francisco.
On a recent Friday night in San Francisco's Tenderloin District, a diverse crowd flocks to Farmer Brown. The restaurant features oversized artwork, live DJs, and a menu starring neo-soul food fresh from California farms. Chef Jay Foster says he started cooking Southern-inspired fare in San Francisco out of desperation when he simply couldn't find soul food that he liked to eat.
I live in a black neighborhood. Does it have to be a funeral or a family reunion for somebody to actually make this food? I mean, you know, why are we not, you know, representing this part of our culture?
This 34-year-old North Carolina transplant decided to make it his mission to help revitalize a threatened piece of African-American heritage.
You know, I see the future, and in future generations, nobody can cook. Nobody really knows or cares about the soul food, and you know, it's going to be gone.
This food tradition originated in the time of slavery, when slaves took sparse rations and discarded food from plantation houses and developed a diet influenced by their African roots. With the Great Migration, the food traveled north and west, and in the Civil Rights era, it was dubbed soul food.
I wanted to go back to the roots, and I wanted to do something that was, you know, original in terms of what was soul food before it was soul food. And that is basically food that came straight off the farms, you know, that our great-grandfathers worked on.
And it has a good, solid sound to it, so it's ready.
With two organic farms in the Central Valley, Will Scott devotes one-third of his crops to Farmer Brown. He is the restaurant's single biggest produce supplier. Wearing a straw hat to ward off the sun, Scott picks the last of his watermelon crop, the base for Farmer Brown's popular margaritas.
we're just about getting ready to mow it down, you know, and get ready for the winter crop, which consists of mustards, collards, turnips, spinach, the red onions, yellow onions, and also some of the broccoli. We're going to do broccoli this year.
Scott comes from a long line of Oklahoma farmers. His family came to California in the early 1950s, but he only became a full-time farmer later in life.
You was encouraged to get an education and get away from it as far as you can, because there's a stigma to it. If you did farm labor, then you know it's like doing slave labor. But there's something about farming, you know, that you really can't get out of your system.
Scott grows 60 different crops and still has never broken even. As president of African American Farmers of California, he works with food justice advocates statewide to help his dwindling number of peers. There are more than 70,000 farms in California, and only about 350 are owned by African Americans.
That's really dismal. It's almost an embarrassment, really. Because, as you know, this country was built by the free labor, you know, that the slaves provided.
Scott describes decades of government discrimination against African American farmers and cites other factors for their small numbers, like development, inheritance taxes, and the aging population. Scott worries about the future of an American food tradition.
You talk about food security, you know, we should make sure that we are there, because, like it says, that if you want a black-eyed peas, you know, who's going to grow it? You need to grow it yourself.
Back at the restaurant, diner Carlos Nieto sits at the end of the bar, eating his third meal this week at Farmer Brown.
Right now I'm actually having Kennebec fries with sweet potatoes. It has a garlic aioli. And then the main dish is an oxtail. It's in a grits. I don't remember what the sauce is, but it also comes with a buttermilk biscuit. And I'm sure Jay's mother taught him how to make it.
The fruits and vegetables of Will Scott's labors show up on almost every plate Chef Jay Foster serves up.
That's going to the pork chop dish, and that's going to go with the sweet potatoes over there, the dandelion greens, and we put a little bit of a plum chutney on top of the pork chop.
And Foster dreams of the day that everything in his restaurant will come from African-American farmers like Will Scott.
For me to do that with an African-American farmer would just, die a happy man.
Lisa Morehouse is a freelance journalist who lives and eats in San Francisco. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question comes from one of America's oldest food market chains. The question is, what do the initials A and P, as in supermarket, stand for? Well, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what do the initials A and P, as in the supermarket chain, stand for? Well, essentially, the name comes from two guys selling clipper ship surplus back in 1859. Now, this was the heyday of clipper ship trade. Those gorgeous, sleek sailing ships docked in Lower Manhattan, and they were loaded with exotica from all over the planet. George Huntington Hartford and George Francis Gilman had connections in the trade. Gilman's father imported leather. But in the hold of his ships were extras: coffee, tea, spices, dried milk. So the two men opened a shop right near the water and started selling. Well, when they got prosperous enough to ship to California and open a store there, they thought big, and they named their company the Great Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company. And they even had their own store brand of tea and coffee. Well, the stores got so well known that in some parts of the country, A&P is still the generic term for supermarket, the way Kleenex is for tissues. It's time for your calls, brought to you by Room and Board. handcrafted furniture for your home at roomandboard.com. Now, you can reach us at 800-537-5252. Anything goes. Okay, let's get right to your calls. We have got Brian calling from Fort Lauderdale. Brian, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, you're welcome.
This is a search that I've been on for a few years, and I hope you may know the answer. A friend of mine used to have a wonderful cook from Chile.
Right.
And she spoke no English, and she was very elderly, and she was just a magician in the kitchen. And she would make a wonderful casserole dish, particularly for entertaining. And it was cornmeal, often in a large casserole. The top was browned and golden. And when you dug into it, it was creamy, almost like polenta. And inside were wonderful surprises, pieces of roast chicken, sausage, hard-boiled egg.
This just sounds like one of those dishes you'd want to know about on General Principle.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And I have asked people from Chile, and some people say, well, it sort of sounds familiar, or they'll mention cornmeal, but I don't know whether it was perhaps an invention or a really sort of published peasant kind of food, food that's passed from person to person. But I would love to be able to find a recipe for this dish. When I would ask her about it, she would smile and nod, and that was the extent of her English. Does this sound familiar to you?
I'm just thinking, there is a dish called pastel de choclo, or something like that, chocolo. And the version I've heard of is done with fresh corn. And the corn is actually pureed and then kind of sautéed with a bit of milk and butter. But it goes on top of this sort of stew. And the stew has what you're talking about in it. It has pre-cooked chicken and sausages in there. And there are herbs and there is raisins and hard-cooked eggs and olives.
Yes,
that's it.
Okay. I remember now.
Because there are these casseroles you find everywhere. You know, if there's a lot of corn in a place, they're going to have corn in them. Mm-hmm. But the thing about this that I remember was that it had you put this mixture of the sort of pureed sweet corn over the top of it, and then you baked it.
Right. I imagine she did a variation on it, because when I would have it would be all different times of year, and often when fresh corn wasn't available. So I'll bet she may have done something with corn.
She might have.
And if substitute.
Yeah, and if she did, she probably pre-cooked it the way you would a polenta. Mm-hmm. Because you wouldn't want to put raw cornmeal. You would just be eating sand. Mm-hmm. And it probably is a dish that everybody makes differently.
Yes.
So you have a lot of freedom.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And boy, it's, and also, you know, the other thing it sounds like is the kind of dish you can do all the components ahead. And then bake it off when you want it.
Sure.
So it would work. Sure. Check the Food Network website and then check Epicurious. Those are two good places to begin.
Okay.
Okay.
I wish I, of course, had watched her make it. But one brief story about the problem with her being a great cook and speaking no English was that this very grand lady was having a dinner party, and this wonderful cook came in, and the lady said, just make me wonderful dishes from Chile, from your native country.
Uh-huh.
And the woman shook her head, you know, nodded yes and smiled. Chile, see? The night came, and the cook came out with a big bowl of chili.
A chili makes
chili.
A lot of sense,
she called
right?
The word chile, and maybe this woman pronounced it chili.
I love it. Hey, enjoy the experimentation with
absolutely.
The dish. You're going to love it.
And I'll let you know if I find it on the internet.
Okay. Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.
You can reach us, 800-537-5252. Who's up next? Let's see. We have got Lynn calling from Miami. Lynn, what do you want to talk about?
Hi. I'd like to talk about a wonderful experience that I had when I was in Spain some time ago. We were on a trip, my daughter, my husband, and I, and we sort of got tired of coffee in the morning and just ordered hot chocolate. And we were served with this delicious, thick concoction of hot chocolate that I have never had anywhere else, and I've never been able to duplicate in the United States, and I just wanted to know how they make it. What is the secret? It's like drinking a melted chocolate bar. It's delicious.
That's the secret. That is actually the secret. I, too, had the hot chocolate for breakfast, and then I decided I should have it in the middle of the morning, and I thought at lunch it would be a very good idea as well.
I hesitated, actually, to find out how it was made.
Yeah, it's dangerous. Did you have it with that long, slender fried... the fried donut that's been heavily sugared?
I tried to avoid that, but I do know about them.
Because that's the great tradition.
Yeah.
The way that hot chocolate is made, to my knowledge, is literally melted chocolate, milk, perhaps some water, and either the chocolate is sweetened or you add sugar to taste. Mm. But that is it. And then it's whipped. You know, you whisk it, and it is just utterly delicious.
It is.
I found in the airport, because we didn't have a lot of shopping time on the trip I was on, and so I picked some up, I think, at one of the airports, and it was a big bar, and it was for making the hot chocolate, and that had some potato starch in it, which may be used, because I know in Italy the hot chocolate will have that potato starch. It's a thickener. But my understanding is chocolate, milk, sugar. That's it. Maybe water if you're on a diet. And it's fabulous.
It is. It's just worth a trip back.
Yeah, it really is. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm reliving.
Okay.
Hey, take care.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye. You can reach us, 800-537-5252. We have Tricia calling from Indianapolis. Tricia, what do you want to talk about?
I would like to talk about emulsification gone bad and what to do about it when the whole integration that happens there just falls apart.
So now, what you're talking about emulsion in the sense of a dressing, like a salad dressing of oil and vinegar?
Salad dressing would be one instance. The one that brought this to mind was actually making mayonnaise, which is a little bit more intensive in emulsification. I was making mayonnaise according to a recipe, and... And at a certain point in the recipe, it had completely emulsified, and then the recipe called for me to add more oil. When I added the more oil, it lost all emulsification, and I figured that the recipe was wrong, and I'd just thrown the ratio off.
Right.
So then I made efforts to correct it by adding more egg and more lemon juice, and that did not work. So my end solution was just to make a whole new batch, but I was curious if there was anything that I could have done to bring it back into the creamy state.
This is my Food Science 101, and I have to say my memory is failing. But I think one of the keys is to add a few spoonfuls of water.
Oh.
Because it's something about having enough liquid to suspend the fat or to hold for the fat to surround the protein. It's something on that order. And I think one of the first solutions would be to add liquid. Could be lemon juice. It could be water, actually.
Okay.
Because my instinct would be your instinct. You're adding more egg, but the egg is more fat, and what you need is a bit of liquid in it.
Okay.
So that would be the answer with the mayonnaise. Now, if you break an emulsion like you're cooking, like you're doing a hollandaise sauce, and you overcook the egg so that it curdles, then you're lost. Then you got to, you know, you sieve away all the melted butter, and you just start again. But in this case, where you're talking about egg yolks, right? Egg yolks, perhaps a little bit of mustard, lemon juice, and then you drizzle in the oil as you're whipping.
Yep.
Add a little water. I think that's going to solve the problem, but I can't remember exactly why.
Okay. Well, I saved the batch that was lost, and I might just try and see if it'll.
Try it. Try it. Just add a little bit. Add a little bit of water, and see if that brings it together.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
You are welcome. You take care. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Call us, 800-537-5252. By the way, just FYI, two fabulous books on food science that you should have in your library because they'll answer all kinds of questions. I mean, the kind of thing that, you know, will stop you in your tracks when you're trying to bake biscuits for the first time, for instance, or trying to make mayonnaise or just trying to make a salad dressing. One is On Food and Cooking by Harold McGee, and the other one is Cookwise by Shirley Currier. If you have those in your library, all your questions will be answered, and I'm making myself a note to check on emulsions when I get home. 800-537-5252. Call us. So a book arrives. You flip it open, And there's a picture of a chef that stops you in your tracks. Why? Well, because it speaks to the essence of what cooking's about, feeding others. And because it is of Chef Gabrielle Hamilton wearing nothing but a chef's jacket as she nurses her child. So what is this book? Well, it's called My Last Supper, 50 Great Chefs and Their Final Meals, Portraits, Interviews, and Recipes. The photographer and author is Melanie Dunay. Melanie, welcome.
Thank you.
So where did the idea for the book come from?
Well, you know, Lynn, I photograph all different types of people, celebrities, authors, even dentists. And as I started to shoot more and more chefs, I realized they were so open and interesting and kind of willing to do anything. An interesting breed, shall we say.
Now, no two of these pictures are alike. Who decided on the style?
Well, the way that it worked was I sent or in person interviewed each chef and asked them, you know, the five questions.
What were the questions?
The five questions I wanted to be super simple, which are: what would be your last meal on Earth? What would the setting be for the meal? What would you drink with your meal? Would there be music? Would anybody be dining with you? And who would prepare the meal? And the reason that I asked, you know, a little bit more than just what would be your last meal is I sort of wanted to paint the entire picture.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I thought that if I asked a few questions that might be a little, you know, unexpected, I could try to get a little more out of the chefs. Because apparently this is a question that they're asked all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I got their answer, I just sat down and brainstormed and brainstormed and brainstormed, tried to take a thread from the actual answers. And then in some cases, when we couldn't speak before, I kind of came up with a few ideas ahead of time.
Tell me the most intriguing shots for you.
Well, I loved the pasta hat. I just thought Lydia Bastianich looked like Eva Perón. You know, I wanted her to look very regal and proud, but yet celebrating being Italian. That was one of my favorites. I do love the Gabrielle Hamilton, and it was a very lovely moment. In fact, originally we were supposed to shoot at Coney Island, but it rained. So we quickly regrouped, went into the studio, and had this incredible moment where she just nursed her baby.
It's a stunning shot. But, you know, there is a moment of nudity in the book that's quite startling. Anthony Bourdain.
Well, yes. Well, you know, Anthony is really a very dear friend of mine and a real lover of food, you know, and he's sort of, you know, up for anything. When you go out for lunch with Tony Bourdain, you never know, you know, what you're going to be eating.
Right.
And I sort of think that there's nothing between him and the food. You know, there's no BS, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
So when I got his Last Supper, which is Fergus Henderson's famous roasted bone marrow with parsley and caper salad,
mm-hmm.
I thought, let's just strip this down and let's have it be a cigarette, a bone, and you.
But this is one that really intrigued me. Masa Takayama, Japanese chef. And you asked him, who would be your dining companions? And he said, my dining companions would be people who keep kosher, as my final wish to see people with dietary restrictions enjoying food they wouldn't normally be allowed to eat.
Isn't that incredible?
It's amazing.
And it comes from such a good place. And when I first got this, actually, this was an interview that took place over the phone. And I said, you know, chef, I just want to make sure that I understand. And he said, you know, the Japanese really were very open after the war. We had a lot of Jewish people come.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to celebrate. And I want to celebrate with them. And I thought, okay, now how am I going to find four Hasidic Jews to be in this picture? That was a bit of a challenge. I promise there was no shellfish anywhere near the shop.
Well, this is good. This is good. Hey, Melanie, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Melanie Dunay is the author and photographer of the book My Last Supper. Now, this is the present for all the chef groupies on your list. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number's 800-537-5252. Have a great week. And until next time, let me leave you with this advice from the great French restaurateur Ferdinand Point. He was talking about how to size up an unfamiliar restaurant. And he said, I ask to meet the chef. If he is thin, I will probably dine poorly. And if he is both thin and sad, the only hope is flight.
Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and supported by Room and Board Home Furnishings, where they believe in handcrafted furniture designed to last for years of holidays to come. You'll find handcrafted American-made furniture and accessories for your home at roomandboard.com. Information about nearly everything you heard here today can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our free weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and for a limited time, for Baker's Chronicle, our newsletter devoted to baking. Sign up at splendidtable.org. And just in case you miss us one week, never fear, you can find free podcasts of our entire program at that very same website, splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Sally Swift and Jennifer Russell with help from Andrew Schumacher. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Have a great week. Please join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.